Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series. Today we'll be focusing on an issue that impacts on all aspects of Australian society and one that will help shape the nation's future in the decades ahead, the Australian Universities Accord. This historic review of our higher education sector is being chaired by Professor Mary O'Kane. It could be said she has one of the most important jobs in Australia right now. But she's eminently qualified, having been a Vice-Chancellor of Adelaide University and a former Chair of the Group of Eight. Professor Mary O'Kane has a history of carrying out reviews of government and scientific agencies in Australia and has been deeply involved with many research centres and has been a member or chair of numerous government and private sector boards and committees. But the panel she now chairs has a daunting task: to deliver a higher education system that meets the current and future needs of the Australian nation. Hello, my name's Ron Cantelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. Well, with me in the studio is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight, who certainly knows the clout that Professor Mary O'Kane brings to her new role. Vicky, you've known and worked with Mary O'Kane over many years. In fact, she was a chair of the Group of Eight, the organisation that you represent. Give us some insight into the leader we're about to meet.
Well, we've got one with a depth of understanding and knowledge across a very broad field. As you said, Mary was the Vice-Chancellor and President of the University of Adelaide. And actually, at the time of her appointment, she was the first woman to be appointed to that post in the then 125-year history. And I think one of the youngest vice-chancellors, Mary, at that point to be appointed.
Second youngest.
Second youngest. She was chair of the Australian Centre for Renewable Energy. She was on the panel of the federal government's review of the National Innovation System. She's a former member of the Australian Research Council, the Cooperative Research Centres Committee, on the board of the CSIRO, New South Wales Chief Scientist. We could do a podcast just on her bio.
Yeah.
Interestingly, she was a pioneer in the field of automatic speech recognition long before any of us were talking about AIs, if we all know what it means.
Yeah.
She's an outback Queensland girl, so she actually does know what it's like to be in the regions as opposed to just, you know, she talks the walk and walks the talk. Graduate of two of our wonderful universities, UQ, as you said, Mary, and PhD at ANU.
Mm-hmm.
And for our South Australian listeners and watchers, she was Don Dunstan's neighbour, something people may not have realised.
Oh, right.
So all of that is to say that she is eminently qualified to lead the government's major review into higher education, which is the University Accord process. The interim report was released just a couple of weeks ago. So, Mary, I'll kick off. You know, it's not like our sector hasn't been the subject of many landmark reviews, inquiries, etc. This is an accord, so it's been couched in a different way by the federal government. But why did we need this review?
That was a question I asked myself, and I answered it somewhat in an op-ed I wrote in January, where I point out that this is an incredible sector. I'd been away from it for quite some time, as you know, not a long way away, sort of in touch, but not in it. And I came back and was very impressed by what the sector had achieved and how it was managing in the face of some really big challenges. And, you know, it made me ask all over again, why are we doing a review? But it's when you look at these terms of reference for this review, and they're very interesting. They talk about doing a review of the sector, they're within asking for certain types of output. One of them is to meet the skills needs for the nation. One is to have sort of parity and equity. And the other one is to be using new knowledge effectively. You could say where maybe on the third, the universities are doing very well because we have a very strong research sector. But whether it's knowledge we need is a bit of a question. But certainly in skills, there is a skills gap, a very big skills gap. And in equity, we don't have the parity of people from the equity groups properly represented in our universities. So to meet a couple of or three big national needs, the sector needs to step up even further. And it's quite a good sector to be asking it to step up because it is very strong. So I think this review is not one about, you know, sort of saying this is a mess and we're trying to clean it up. This is about saying how can Australia be much stronger, both economically and socially. And our universities are one of those strong things we can leverage.
Although in the report does say that without change, Australia's higher education system will rapidly become unfit for purpose. And as a result, the current higher education system is in a stressed state. So I agree with you. I think we're in a pretty good position, but there are things we can do better. How did you address that particular issue in the report?
In terms of the stressed state and what to do better, particularly looking at, as you notice, we talk quite a bit about funding. Mm. So one of the things is to put a series of funding principles down and to talk a lot about data and metrics to sort of understand what is the nature of the problems, to be able to track what's going on and to move to a very sustainable funding model. One of the problems is just that, is the will the funding hold up? And, you know, you only have to look at, say, yesterday's Financial Times, very interesting article on the UK university's financial system. I think there's a lot of stress in the sector, in the sector around the world. And one of the things we're looking at is what is the minimal things to take that stress away. Funding's one, looking at governance is another, looking at economies of scale and economies of practice are other things that go right through the report. And we try and connect a lot of those things, even though we talk a lot about skills and equity. We also talk about learning and teaching, research, the core business of the university, and how that might be done in a way that actually will make the universities more sustainable while still being very good.
The interim report quite rightly has a really strong focus on equity and participation. And that isn't a surprise, I guess, given where we kind of ended with Bradley in terms of targets. And also the minister was very clear that, you know, he wants uplift. I guess from my perspective, though, if I'm honest, I look back at Bradley, I look at the demand-driven system, and no one would disagree that we need uplift and we need more people going to university and a broader representation of the community in which we live. But how do you pay for that? Because it didn't work out with the demand-driven system.
No, it didn't. And how do you not pay for it is another question we ask ourselves. And we looked hard at why it didn't work post the Bradley Review, which talks about it and highlights the issue very, very well. But one of the things we've more than tentatively come to the conclusion is that you do need to do a lot of things. It's not just about getting more people in the door. It's about a very tightly coupled set of arrangements. One is building aspiration. Some people don't know they might like to go to university or don't know what universities do or what they might do for them. So one of it is that. Part of it is helping people get into universities. What do you do? What are the appropriate enabling programs? How do you get people through enabling programs? How do you make sure they get credit for going through in case they leave at that point? How do you do what we call scaffolding around students once they're into higher ed? How do you actually make sure that they get appropriate study programs and study support? How do you remove the roadblocks that are making it hard for them, whether they can find employment, whether they can manage the cost of living, because often they're from particularly economically disadvantaged arrangements, or from a country where they have to sort of live out of home. So how do you manage all of that? It's not just one size, you know, one size fits all, sort of richer and poorer students, but it's putting the whole thing around them, and that is going to be more expensive. So we're quite upfront that it's not a place for an equity student in some form is going to cost more.
And, of course, the panel is not about where the money comes from. That is actually up to the government. I understand that. It wouldn't surprise you, though, that my focus would be around international education and research, group of eight universities. Mm-hmm. You know, we're big research players in the mix, and
also big equity players too. I think
players, absolutely. And thank you for saying that, because we are, and we're not often recognised for that.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to highlight that, because the group of eight often do wonderful things. And one of the things that we hear from the equity groups is they want to get through to courses that are particularly highly represented in the group of eight, you know, be it medicine or dentistry, engineering, veterinary science, and law, they're in other universities, but they're sort of in their concentrated forms, often in the group of eight. And it's how you get more of them through in that system. And I think the group of eight will be absolutely key to that.
And that does go to your aspiration point, that having people believe that they can go to any university, including a group of eight, because we have had this discussion with the minister who went to UNSW, and his view was, you know, you shouldn't just, not just, but if you want to go to any university, you should be able to. Mm-hmm. But there would be a cohort of students who would just think they could never go to a particular university, let alone even go to university.
But one of the things the student leaders have told us is that it's really important that there be good transfer between universities because of this issue, that students often do want to go and do medicine in the group of eight. And how can they make sure they can move, you know, after they've done one year in another university, that they can get across without having to go through a whole palaver of entry requirements?
I don't even know how you navigate the transfers, because it's hard for anybody. We make it overly complex.
We do. So how might we make it really easy, I think, is one of the great challenges that I know group of eight will rise to.
But isn't one of the fundamental things that it seems to me, having watched debates about funding for many, many years now, it seems that it's become more skewed towards a reliance on international student fees, less money from government. Even former Hawke Education Minister John Dawkins has talked about the need to overhaul the system, that it's not fit for purpose, that it doesn't have the money to fund all the things that you want it to fund. And yet, I notice in the Accord report, it talks about the possibility of a levy on international student fees, which would cause some problems for those universities that have spent a great deal of effort in building up a client base and then having their funds raided to support the other universities that haven't done so well in that space.
We were asked for spiky ideas, and we delivered. And that's one of the spiky ideas. There's quite a few spikies through the report. And there's some that are almost contradictory. But we put them on the table to see, because, Vicky, even though, as you said, it's not our job to find the money, there is a fair bit of encouragement to point to directions where there might be money. So there is the...
Well, that would be a tax on Group of Eight universities. I mean, I'll put it out there.
And on some others too.
Well, I'd say you probably got about a dozen universities in the country which do the heavy lifting on international education. And it is a spiky idea, and the prick is hurting. Mm-hmm. We don't like it, and I'm sure we'll make that point, because it does, I mean, it goes to the point that I have talked about for years in this sector, that we have a distorted funding model, whichever way you look at it, where we have relied on a particular source of income to fund research. So for every $1 of research funding that the Group of Eight gets from the ARC or the NHMRC, we have to find $1.20. And if we do 70% of Australia's university-based research, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So, and COVID kind of ripped that Band-Aid off, and we now know, we've always known it, but, you know, it's out in the public domain that a lot of that funding and that reliance comes from international student income. I mean, we have just spoken to Peter Varghese, the Chancellor of the University of Queensland. Now, Peter advocated in 2018 to set up a future fund, which they have done at the University of Queensland, for exactly this reason, in terms of putting that international income into a future fund so that when there are shocks in the system, I think that's a good idea. And I think that you'd find universities would be receptive to that. I'm not sure you'll find, I know you won't find from the Group of Eight, and I'm not asking you to comment, Mary, because I know that you put the spiky idea in, and it won't surprise you what our view is. But we see it as nothing more than an envy tax, frankly, and that was the label that one of my soon-to-be departing vice-chancellors called it, soon to be the Governor of Victoria. And you know, if universities want to do that, to fund their research, then that's fine, but it doesn't go to the issue, which is how do you fund research in this country? And I think that's the issue that we really need to unpick. And so how do you think you've unpicked that in your report?
Okay. I will comment on the envy tax. I think it's a good idea if it causes counter spikes, that people come up with good ideas. You know, should there be another future fund of some sort? You know, should the MRFF be generalised? Well, you know, whatever. The way we're looking at funding increase over the time. So rather than just not like it, which I can completely understand, it could send a message, you know, what is the best idea? So it's a big call for submissions, good ideas that do throw some money into the system, preferably to fund research, but, you know, for anything else needs to be there. But then how do we fund research, I think, begs another question. Because, you know, as I said, Australian university research is very, very good in international terms and good in dimensions that are really underappreciated. You know, the university's research sort of carries all the heavy lifting on basic research and strategic basic research. It does a lot of the applied research nationally, does all the research training. No other institution, Australian universities, can offer research training, even if they have associate supervisors and so on in the PhD. And it does an awful lot of the breakthrough solving of wicked problems. And I think that is one of the issues. And that takes me to the issue that I think underpins that how do we fund it, is how do people appreciate what Australian university research is and what it does? And I think until we get that right, it's going to be hard to get the type of funding we need, because this, as we train more PhD students, we have more research capacity and we need more funding. And while there are going to be more academic jobs with the growth in the sector that is needed for the skills need, so that will help a little bit in the whole system, or more than a little bit, help a lot, we do really need to get a deep understanding by person in the street, yep, about Australia, why Australia's university research is vital to our economy, to our society, to our future. I mean, I cite the cases that I don't just do reviews of higher ed. Two of my big reviews just before this were on the floods in New South Wales and the big bushfires. And the core and the essence of a lot of the recommendations in those two reviews come out of using university research advice over what the future of climate is going to be like in New South Wales and how we can deal with it. And that in particular, you know, I'd like to call out the ARC Centre of Excellence in Climate Extremes, Jason Sharples at ADFA, you know, the world's bushfire expert on extreme bushfires. You know, if we didn't have those people, you know, we couldn't protect our houses and lives in, you know, this state anyway that I'm in. And that needs to be appreciated and understood. Once it is appreciated, understood, and people realise they can't live without it, then I think the funding gets easier to get.
You are like singing my song sheet here. And it's part of the reason we started these podcasts, mm-hmm, frankly, 40-odd podcasts ago, to really try and unpick some of these issues and talk to researchers. Because until it is actually an issue, I always talk about the consequence of inaction. If we didn't do this research, what would happen? And you've given us a really good example with the bushfires. I've just come back from Europe and the UK, where we had a very strong focus, a business and industry focus, around the opportunities of AUKUS Pillar 2, which will be underpinned by research and innovation in key areas around quantum, AI, hypersonics, et cetera. So I think that we're slowly getting there, but you're quite right. Until the person on the street realises we can't do without it, mm-hmm, that is the battle we keep fighting. And I'm not sure whether – I don't know how we do that other than what we're doing now.
But even so, if I can be devil's advocate, mm, here, say the punter in the street, you know, acknowledges, and I think many would, that, you know, the universities do amazing work and they come up with all kinds of drugs that impact on our health, mm, et cetera. So they accept that. At the end of the day, you've still got this issue about where you get the funding to grow research. And that seems to me, isn't that still a major government problem, you know, effectively having to fork out some more cash? Even though John Dawkins says in his statements that, you know, governments are sick of it.
No, that's true, and he's right too. It is about governments forking out more cash, but governments have to get elected. And unless the person in the street who is the voter is keen on it, big government, a really big government development in this area, you know, a really major new policy program in research will require electoral support. And so it is a matter of making sure people know about it. But the other side of it is particularly industry. And unless our, you know, the Business Council of Australia calls for, you know, strengthening Australian research and saying how you know, the big industry players and the very large number of small and medium enterprises we have in Australia really uses the research sector, and particularly the university research sector, to solve their problems and turn to it. And our universities are fantastic at problem solving, at problem specifying and then solving. Unless we have that, we won't get the government putting the money in either. But if we do get it working, we'll have extra money from industry, and there'll be very synergistic effects there. The other thing is we should hope that we get investment from other countries. This is a country where we get relatively low investment in our research from outside Australia. And yet we publish a large number of our scientific papers jointly with people from other countries. It's not as though we don't have the links and the connections. So one of the things we call for in the international section is for, you know, much greater promotion of Australia's research capacity in our universities by organisations like AusTrade. We really do need to make sure people know that we're pretty good.
Can I bring it back to another point in the report? And we've talked about international students, we've talked about research, we've talked about funding, but in an opinion piece in The Australian, you reference work done by demographer Bernard Salt. He's referred to the great skills shift currently taking place in our society, and he referred to a 13% increase in our population over a five-year period, but a 21% increase in the number of skill level one workers, those needing university qualifications, etc. How can our universities continue to meet this demand? And is it time to rethink the notion of universities dedicated to research and other universities dedicated to skills training and the creating the sort of workers that industry needs? Do we need to hive off the two in some way?
I'll take that in various parts. One is, where do we see the numbers coming from? And we see the numbers particularly coming from the equity side, that there really is not a lot of demand for university places at the moment with high employment on. But the one area where there's not a lot of going to university is in the equity groups. And so that's why there is one of the strong emphases on equity, because that will be there to address skills needs. In terms of whether there should be specialist universities, yes, we say and we explore the possibility that there could be a variety of types of universities, because our universities do look very alike in lots of ways. I mean, yes, there are differences, but they're probably more alike than they are different. Even though we might see specialist research universities, and of course, you know, the ANU was originally to be set up as a specialist research university, has gone a long way from that. I don't think our big universities would ever want to move away from the skills areas. They're the great producers of the high-level skills of the nation, you know, of the big professions, you know, engineering, the most important profession first, and then, you know, medicine, dentistry, vet, as I mentioned, law. And they're very, very good at doing the, you can call it training, I'd also call it education that is required at high skills level, and supporting some of the other big skills producers at postgraduate level, for example, medical colleges and so on. And so I think we will see specialist institutions, but I also think our grand research universities will be major producers of people with skills.
I guess the flip side of the question is, or at least the commentary, and we did say this in our submission, that should every university do research?
And we suggest probably not, but it shouldn't be a forced arrangement. People should say, we're going to specialise in this way, you know, we're going to be performing arts, or, you know, if you think of the old pharmacy school, which is, but it actually did do research. But no, we think those things are very worth looking at. And also then, how do you create them? Are they created de novo? Should they be created by existing institutions and spun off as little siblings, or should they be specialist? What happens? Another thing we look at is what happens if you create a totally new university. There haven't been many new public sector universities.
So the report does propose a new university, doesn't it?
We raise it as a possibility. And certainly there are areas in Australia where there's high population density and low university reach, and that's one of the reasons, of course, for the proposal for more RUCs and the Outer Metropolitan University centres as well. But there could be new universities, and they might be created to be, you know, the next one in the group of eight, the group of nine might be about to be created. I like teasing one of my co-panel members and talking about the Macklin University.
You're doing this ongoing work. You've got more work to do from now until December. What else has to happen now in that interim period?
Really to finish off the report, to work out the recommendations, to take on board all the wonderful submissions that we're going to get by the 1st of September and to turn that into a piece that is hopefully something government will like so much that it desperately wants to fund.
So what sort of university can you see emerging in Australia by 2050 based on the recommendations that come out of this Accord report?
Oh, I've answered that. That's all written. You can read it in the Spikey report. There's a section called Vision.
Yep.
And a vision for Australia's future higher ed system. And while it doesn't talk about spaceships and doing things with all sorts of advanced technologies, it tries to give the basics of what would be needed. And certainly talks about a very different style to some extent of education. One where we rely on a lot more on the knowledge repositories that we're seeing increasingly, and where the teaching goes back to be something, if you like, back to the future with a lot more really high quality face-to-face tutorial. And that face-to-face might be virtual face-to-face, but it is actually small group intensive arrangements. Where the research is, as we talked about, much appreciated by the person in the street, by industry, you know, says we can't do without our universities. They're absolutely vital. Where it is close to a universal education higher ed system, where people can go to universities or to the vet sector and actually get a good qualification that allows them to do well in the workforce and to be able to come back and do things, to have an entitlement to come back, study more, to reskill in different parts, both all around the tertiary sector. We sort of also want to make sure that our universities are very much part of our communities. They are at the moment. They're a very important part, and something that in a democracy is very important, that there's the intellectual life and they contribute a lot to the cultural life. We want to see more and more of that. So that's a few things in the vision, but it's all there in three or four pages.
It sounds truly wonderful and visionary, but it's still underpinned by the big question, where does the money come from?
That's right, and we've got to really make the point, not just about the research, but about everything, that universities are an incredibly good investment, and that we've got to show that they are. It's both how they perform and what happens. And to that point, a lot of the issue is about, for us, the challenge, to go back to your question there, is about how we devise things that are really good incentives for universities to behave in certain ways. Because the important thing is the sector is incredibly good at, if you like, gameplay and responding to various competitions the government sets out, you know, a little
following
bit of funding.
Following the pots of money, is what you mean.
And an awful lot of time and effort goes into those things. Well, we don't want quite as much time and effort over small things, but over big things, we do want lots of time and effort. And I don't think it's for the Accord panel review to say this is exactly how it should happen. It's more that we need to think of the incentives to get the types of behaviours and then let the sector do it. It's a very creative, very clever sector. And the best thing is to sort of let it loose, performing well.
Mary O'Kane, it's obviously an issue that's going to come back, and we'll be talking about this in the months and years ahead. But thank you so much for the work you've done thus far, and good luck with the work ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.